Are you ready? We have a question from Mary.
No.
Oh, we don't have a question from Mary.
Yes.
We have a goodie from Tom.
I wanted to ask about Newton and alchemy and whether or not anything's been written about it. There's been plenty. I found this NOVA documentary, which is very following, and it kind of gives you an idea how they approach it, but Newton's dark secrets. And so, I mean, the study of alchemy is considered one of his dark secrets. Not the fact that he lived with a guy for 20 years who was his, what do you call it, amanuensis or something. They shared close quarters. That's not a dark secret. But the other one was that he studied the Bible, had a really close, did some close reading of the Bible, and rejected the notion of the Trinity. Anyway, it's an interesting documentary, and they have some historical reenactments and some anecdotes. If you've ever watched NOVA before, great graphics. So you don't really suffer, I mean, any lack of good information and explanation about science. And it really does make a suggestion that his interest in alchemy really did help lay the foundation for a study of chemistry. We know it's chemistry. So that's something, and we might even want to think about watching that, actually.
Did you get the library, Tom?
I got the library, yes. And then a fabulous resource. This is a biography called The Last Sorcerer, which basically it totally delves into his work. I think it was 1997 it was published. 1997.
That fits in a little bit what I asked the last time. Go ahead.
Well, he's on a roll. Let him go.
Yeah, he's on a roll. I know.
There's more. A couple things. There was a large body of his works about alchemy. Newton's works on alchemy were collected by the economist John Maynard Keynes, and he eventually donated them to King's College, Oxford. He passed away as part of his quest, and scholars have now just been studying that since about the 40s. So there have been about 30 years, or 50 years, plus 60 years, I guess, of study of this material. And there's still a lot of controversy. And even in the Cambridge Companions of Newton, which the Cambridge Companions series is kind of a great, they collect sort of the top scholars in a given field to look at historical figures in science and literature and humanities and stuff. And so there's even some sort of conflict about how they feel about his studies now. And I'll just read you just a couple of quick things here just to give you an idea about the combination of exact science and magical thinking, which today can only be seen as schizophrenic, corresponds to a 17th century mode of thinking. The tension evident in Newton's personality and work is also characteristic of an era which tried to combine tradition and progress in science with mystical revelation and metaphysics. You know, and this is really relevant to the thing we're working on with the Fled Kepler sort of dialogue and the fact that Pauli's been moved to go back to study that. Well, it happened over the course of several hundred years, this kind of debate within the sort of the magical worldview, which was exemplified by alchemy, and then the sort of the emergent scientific, quote-unquote, rational worldview. And again, so it shows that even in the 21st century, we have to badmouth that kind of magical thinking or the irrational thinking. And there's a lot of concern about that whether or not Newton's studies in alchemy actually did contribute anything at all to, for example, action at a distance, which is a very quote-unquote occult study given to the Hermeticists and various magical thinkers. When you think about gravitation, something is having an action at a distance. A force is is having an effect on another object over a distance, and it's invisible. You can measure its effects, but at any rate, it does take a sort of a stretch of the imagination to think that perhaps he did in fact use his alchemical studies to further his scientific studies, because he was very methodical in his approach to all this stuff, and that is a hallmark of the scientific method today. So there are just several sort of things. I brought some of those pieces here, but just to show that this kind of study has been going on back and forth, and yes, in fact, there is a lot of literature about Newton's alchemy. Not all of it's kind and thoughtful, but
I'm surprised though is that the Jungians haven't. Jungians have been. He didn't pay much attention to that. I would see if there was anything
to what
to the alchemy of Newton.
Oh, to Newton? No. No. I think it comes up here implicitly in the Flood-Kepler dialogue. That's the issue. But what I like so much is you can see how it's vilified. Mm. Schizophrenic.
I know. Schizophrenic thinking.
And in fact, it's where the future lies to try to reconcile these two.
Future present schizophrenic. Yes. We can be embraced.
But you know, the other thing that kind of ties in with this in the this book I was telling you, I'm reading on the God Particle by Lee.
Yeah.
He's talking about at one point this one scientist who discovered the basic relationship, Schrodinger. Yeah. And what he described, he actually, you know, describes it in a way that is down to earth of how it actually happened that mm-hmm. he discovered that relationship, where he actually goes off on a weekend mountain retreat, and it actually brought the real down to earth detail that it was with a mistress.
Mm-hmm.
And
Adoniram Jackson looked at her while he was working on the form of
that. And in that weekend, he came up with what most scientists, including Einstein, was one of the most miraculous relationship, elegant relationship. And I'm beginning to think that the unconscious is working in some of those kind of work earlier.
Hello.
I mean, so that we may see in some of this stuff that has come up, and I think that's what you're saying, that with Newton, it was the at least in part some of the work of the unconscious. I mean, that's kind of how people related to it. That it was so beautiful,
mm-hmm.
that what he came up with, that relationship, and all of the things that come from that relationship. I mean, it's like a gold mine, the Schrodinger equation, but that it must be something bigger than just rational thought. And how it happened.
Well, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Just for those of you who don't know Schrodinger, you know, we're talking about Pauli, Heisenberg, and Bohr. Well, that's one set of guys who came up with one set of formulas. Schrodinger is another guy, S-C-H-R-O-umlaut, two dots over it, D-I-N-G-E-R, Erwin, E-R-W-I-N.
But I guess what I'm saying is that
I just want to fill them in who Schrodinger is. I don't think they know who he is. He came up with another set of formulae, not in contradiction to, but another angle at solving, of explaining what goes on inside the atom. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there is this idea that the way, in terms of the theories, the way this comes out, it comes out in the beautifulness of the mathematical formula,
yeah.
which then people later can evolve that to make all kinds of implications, and that's what happened with the Schrodinger equation. And Einstein said that it was one of the most beautiful, elegant things. But the way and Lieberman takes the time to tell you exactly how it happened. You know, he went away on a retreat. And with a mistress, which is, it doesn't seem like right that you ought to be doing this beautiful stuff with, But I think possibly the way we've been talking about it here, that there's other things going on within the inner workings of him mm-hmm. that came together mm-hmm. in some kind of a way that allowed him to write this and discover this mathematical formula that people say was just, it's like...
Yeah.
Elegant, par excellence.
Yep. Schrodinger, then the Heisenberg, he really came up with the basic formulas for the Copenhagen group. Another guy, Paul Dirac, I think, came up with another set of equations.
Yeah.
They're the three big descriptive models, and they all start from a different premise. Schrodinger looks at the electron as a wave. And I don't know about Dirac, what he does, but anyway,
it's... The big thing that came out of Dirac, he's dealing with his Lieberman at the same time, is that Dirac, from his formula, they call it his beautiful formula, too, you
get the, it is implied from this formula that the electron has spin. From the formula itself,
yeah.
And this is kind of like the beautifulness of these mathematical formulas that come perhaps with the working from the workings of the unconscious.
Mm-hmm. Has
spin,
isn't
she saying? Spin. And spin is really important, for example, like in nuclear magnetic resonance, MRI, that you use in even hospitals now, that's based on the spin of the nucleus. You wouldn't have it without the idea of spin. That small particles like electrons and protons have spin.
And yes, it's like planets. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Pauli's exclusion principle.
Right. And Pauli later makes use of that, and that allows you to explain the whole periodic chart, that electrons have spin. Mm-hmm. Even though these particles have point-like structures. I mean, they don't have dimensions. And yet, this is the mysticism of it. How can you have something that's at a point and you have spin? But the spin comes from the equations themselves. So the equations have a kind of a mystical quality to them.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but... I mean, you're just facts we don't yet understand is what I'd say.
Right.
But who knows?
Yeah.
Thank you. I thought what I do with Tom's, I'm going to copy this. I'm going to look at it. If I think it's super, super good, maybe I'll ask Nancy if we can watch it at her place. But I think what I might instead do is like make 3 copies of it and pass it around so you guys can maybe share it. And I think Tom said just about the first half hour is what we might.
We're just rolling through what we're talking about. The other half hour is about his investigation of Christianity and stuff.
So we'll follow up on this. I'll let you know what I decide. Any questions? Maybe I'll just do a quick review. Let's say if you go back to Dream 7, he sees Christ with a striped nose, which had to do with this whole business of oscillation. Does that sound familiar? And the challenge for Pauli is to accept that time has this oscillatory quality, meaning there's a wave-like way of describing time, that each moment of time can have a different quality than another moment of time. The main point, bringing this back to really down-to-earth stuff, is a synchronicity is a different moment of time. So if normal time is the black, then the synchronicity is the white, or if the normal is the white, then the synchronicity is black. There are alternating qualitative descriptors that we can apply to time. Again, why is that so important? I'm always trying to bring this back to just ordinary experience, because that means there are certain moments that you can't blow. Certain moments you're given opportunities for the whole next phase of your life. And if you blow it, you've blown the whole next phase of your life. We see that more and more as people work through the past damage and begin dealing with the unconscious as a present creative factor. That really, to use the proper vocabulary, synchronistically, when the individual is ready to begin a new phase inwardly, outwardly the opportunity for that new phase appears. And that is a synchronicity. That's a specific moment of time. And often your next 1 to 5 to 10 years depends on that opportunity that came your way. If you're asleep and you blow it, then you're in big trouble. So that's why it's so important. With Pauli, it's going to be von Franz. The synchronistic event to come his way was the relationship with von Franz to help him complete this work, and he blew it. So that's the oscillation, why it's so, so very important, that we don't think that we just create everything ourselves. Certain opportunities are given to us. And it's why I if you don't mind me griping for a minute, well, I get so sick of this causal psychology because it keeps saying, look what happened, and you can see, but look what's happening. You're getting new opportunities all the time, and you're complaining about what happened to you. So you're just perpetuating the past. So, of course, we do causal work in our field. It's very important. I don't mean to diminish it. But at a certain point, you have to realize, I understand what happened. I'm going to take responsibility for the way I adapted to what happened, and I'm going to try to work that through, and I'm going to see that there's a new day ahead and receive the gifts, so to speak, that the universe presents, which is a poetic way of saying asynchronously. So that's why this oscillation is so important. Then we talked about Flood as Kirchhoff. That was it got us thinking about how scientific theory has an imagistic background, kind of like what Ted was saying. We better go up here. Oh, it's a phone.
No, I don't think
no.
It's a phone.
Okay. Maybe it's that opportunity knocking me.
Something ringing.
It's ringing. Hello. This is God. Yes. I'm listening. Then we had the dream of the Persian putting objects through the window in Pali's office. We're going to see the Persian again. The Persian would represent Zarathustra. We've talked about the mind-body split, how Zarathustra came back to heal that. Into the office window, answers a question Nancy asked, or begins to answer a question that Nancy asked, which I thought was very important several weeks ago. You know, is there something Pali should do? Yes. Begin lecturing on the very kind of things we're talking about. And so the Persian coming into his workspace would be representative of that task being announced to him. There was no chair, which means maybe a couple of things, that there was no relationship between Pali and the ground. We're going to see that again. And we could take that a little more literally, that he is to have a new chair of physics, metaphorically speaking, that his understanding of his role as professor and what he lectured on was to change. But then we started the dream, which we stopped on, and I think I'll just go back and reread that so we can head up there. Page 43. Now remember that right before this dream, Jung and Pali had met either for lunch or dinner or whatever, a stroll, and they had talked about synchronicity, and Pali had, we know Pali encouraged Jung very strongly to write about synchronicity. Jung hadn't had the courage to do it up to that time. You can see why, because that sort of work by the academic world is considered idiotic. It's magical thinking. But Pali, as a scientist, gave Jung the courage to publish it regardless. And I think Pali's affirmation meant a great deal for Jung. On the other hand, I think probably what Jung was giving Pali at the time was supporting him to understand synchronicity not only as a theoretical concept, but as a real fact in his life. I don't think the von Franz thing was at issue yet, but probably Jung's intuition, and I think we can see it in the dreams. The dreams are beginning to hint that something's going to happen. And that's often the case. Before these events occur in reality, you can kind of see hints for them in the dreams. So what Pali was, what Jung was saying to Pali was, this synchronicity thing is not just an archetypal concept that's useful for you in physics. You have to watch what is really happening in your own personal life. We don't know that for a fact, but I suspect that was the case given the nature of this dream. So here's the dream after their evening together. I see a river which flows from north to south, as does the from south to north, as does the Rhine. A dark man goes into the river and is swallowed up by it. In this moment, the mother appears, only similar in features to my personal mother, and asks me what colors I have chosen. I respond by saying I have chosen black-white. Immediately, a hexagram appears with black and white stripes on a piece of paper, and the mother disappears. I don't think I did. You are familiar with I Ching hexagram. Is there anyone who's not? It's six straight lines. Hexagram number one. I'll come back to that. Now a man with blonde hair comes. Now remember the blonde. We have the blonde man and woman and the dark man and woman. The blonde will represent his mental understanding, and the dark woman would represent his emotional, erotic, relational life. A gush of air blows the piece of paper into his face so that the stripe pattern remains marked on his nose. And that's reminiscent of Dream 7, remember the Christ, which I alluded to when we started. Now the man with the striped nose is startled as he observes three pieces of wood on the ground. And that is, well, actually I do, I think I did include that. Did you check out the picture? There is a picture in the back. It's on your page letter B, no wait, yeah, page letter A. Page where it says page 56. That's the German page. The I Ching number one is on the left, and the sticks on the ground is the figure to the right of it.
Now the lines are alternating white and black.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's a kind of alternation.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe, are you sure, is everyone, just being polite, that you're familiar with I Ching, or are you really familiar with it? Everyone is familiar with it. Are you familiar with it?
I've seen it, but I don't know.
Let me give you a quick, because if you don't get this, you'll be really lost. We're going to come back to it. So bear with me while I just give you a quick. In I Ching, you throw Chinese Oracle, probably goes back to, I don't know, way, way, way B.C. And you throw, there are several ways to do it. The easiest way is to throw three coins. And to make a long story short, you count up their numerical value, and you either get a broken line or a solid line. I'm making it very simple. It's actually a little bit more complicated. You do it six times. So you get, depending on the numbers, you get a series of six lines. And there are 64 possibilities. These are called hexagrams. There are 64 possibilities of results you can get permutating six lines two times.
With white and black also included?
Well, that's just the space between.
Oh, okay.
That's just the space. So you get six lines, yes, there's a space between. Now, the hexagram that he's dreaming of is hexagram one, which is all straight lines. And it's hexagram number one. Each hexagram has a name and a meaning. Hexagram number one is the creative.
Is the which?
Creative.
Oh.
And so the way you use the I Ching, you do not ask it for advice. That's the first thing. You take a stand. And this is the way it was taught to me anyway. You take a stand and you say, this is my decision. I'm going to get divorced, or I'm not going to get divorced, or we're going to go to counseling, or we're not going to go to counseling, or I'm going to, I don't think you're supposed to do it for money, but I'm going to invest money, I'm not going to invest money, whatever it is. You give it a point to react to. And it should be in a state of suffering. That's something we often forget. I'll explain why. And then you say to the I Ching, what will be the outcome if I take this course of action? and then it gives you a response. Responses are well, I should have brought the book along. There are 64 possible responses telling you what the outcome will be. Some of them are just flat out positive, some of them are flat out negative, and some are a mixture corresponding to the things that happen when you make decisions and act on them. Hexagram number one is of the most important. I don't use the I Ching a whole lot, but I've used it for 20, probably 30 years. And I've got hexagram number one twice. Once when I asked what would be the outcome of working with von Franz on my thesis, and the other time, what would be the outcome of working with C.A. Meyer on my supervision. And both of them were like the most creative experiences of my life. I know it may be hard to believe, but this one just does not appear very often. And when it does, it's usually a very big deal. That the outcome of what you have decided to do will be extraordinarily positive, extraordinarily creative. So that's a very quick nutshell on the I Ching.
Is there any element of symmetry that is considered in the lab?
If you don't know it, I'd recommend buying a book. Get the Wilhelm translation. I think it's the easiest place to start.
The one that Jung introduced. I have that, but I didn't have a book I've gotten to.
Yeah. See, the book, like the Bible, is I took a course on it in Zurich from a professor of Chinese, and it was very interesting. I may have told you this, when I started taking the course, there was about 8 of us that hired her to teach us this, and this is where I learned what I'm telling you now. And this is the stupidest thing I have ever heard in my life. And about halfway through the course, it was like we were sitting around the table. We met her apartment, a little smaller group. And she stopped and she said, everyone here I feel is with me except you. And I said, you're right. I think this is the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. And she was very nice about it, didn't get upset. But she said, well, just try it sometime. And I did. And it flabbergasted me how accurate it is, and still it flabbergasts me how accurate it is. The thing I said about you should be suffering, see, the idea is, which is a complete logical contradiction, is that you are trying to create a synchronicity. And since synchronicity implies the activation of an archetype, your psyche has to be in an activated state so that the I Ching can respond to that archetype activated in you. That's how I explain it. It's actually logically contradictory because I've said that there is no such thing as causality, but we're causing it. Well, I can't help that. That just seems to be the way it works. And I use it from time to time. I use it with some folks in therapy, and it is astoundingly accurate. But if you overuse it, it's like, I don't know, it's like what, like French fries. They start tasting bad. A French fry now and then is fine, but every day, bleh. And the same way with the I Ching. If you save it for those major moments, like maybe, I think if you're doing it more than once a month, that's too often. A couple times a year when you're really cooking, should I sell my house and move into a condo? Not how do I make money of it, but will I be happy in the condo? Will I regret that decision? That kind of decision. Should I pursue this relationship? Should I end this relationship? Those sorts of major questions. So, Pali is getting in here hexagram number one. Which means?
It seems like it's when the tension, when it works and there's the tension of the opposites are there.
Right.
Torn between.
Exactly. Right. And what it does, it shows you the middle way.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's very positive in the dream. And you see, that was what was on the man's nose, the Christ's nose, earlier. Three times I threw it. The third time I threw it, give you an idea what it's like. I had run out of money in training. And I'm saying this to illustrate what the point I want to make. I run out of money. I had been promised a fellowship and lost it. I didn't lose it. was withdrawn for technical reasons. The starting of the year of the Jung Institute didn't correspond with the starting year. There's all this paperwork crap that I lost a couple years worth of financing. The dollar dropped, so I was really bereft. And I threw the I Ching, which, what will be the outcome if I remain? Number one, no moving lines, be creative. Okay, you son of a bitch. Let's just see whether you put your money where your mouth is. So, I literally did not have enough money to fly home. I think I had 200 francs left in the bank, and that's like that time was like $100. Louise Motti, some of you know Louise, let me stay in her apartment. I didn't have money for a place to stay, and she was back in the States for the summer. And said, "You can stay at my place for free." So I'm in, eternally indebted to Louise. And so I had a place to stay. I had just enough money to eat, and I didn't have money for transportation, so I was hitchhiking. And in Switzerland, you could get a ride like that. I don't know if it's the case now, but then it was a very, very safe country, so there was no problem. So I was hitchhiking one day, and I couldn't get a ride. I waited, and I waited for about 45 minutes. Going back to Louise's apartment. I couldn't believe it. All of a sudden, up pulls a little Morris Minor. Dal Sharp, the guy who publishes inner city books. Hi, Dal. Hi, Dal. How you doing? I said, "Well, actually, I'm kind of sucking. I'm out of money. I think I'm going to have to go home." He said, "Well, get in the car. I'll give you a ride." He said, "So I had passed my propedeutic, the midpoint exam, which says that you're probably going to make it. If you don't pass that, you're probably not going to." So it means I'm a solid investment. So he said, "Oh, you're out of money." And I said, "Yeah, I really need a miracle. I've got to get some money. I've got to find a job." Well, getting a job in Switzerland is almost impossible for foreigners. And he says, "Well, I'm graduating, and I have two teaching jobs. And they pay $200 an hour. Do you want them?" That's how I pay for my training. The next 5 years I taught, I could teach, 12 hours a week and live pretty comfortably because teachers are so extraordinarily well paid. So, see, that's the creative that the universe responds. And hexagram number one says, the creative, wait, the universe will respond. So I give you that story, and you can think what it was like working with Juan Franz, how something creative comes in from the outside to really further your journey. So that's what is trying to come to Pali here, not just his own creative power, but the creative power of the universe. And you realize, I think, if you're working creatively, that they're really the same thing. One is just a larger picture of the other. So that's background to hexagram number one.
Just briefly, where does the suffering, you think, maybe come in?
Well, as I said, you have to be the way this teacher explained it to us, which I thought was very good. The I Ching is like a dream. Dreams aren't just going to come and tell you how to live your life, because they compensate. They are a reactive process, and for them to have integrity, you have to have integrity. People say, "Well, my dreams never tell me this or that." And you look at their lives, you understand why. The dreams can't be bothered, because they're just not solid people. But if the ego maintains a strong position and endures the tension of, "I want to do this, I want to do this, I don't want to do this, I want to do several things, or I don't want to do anything, but whatever it is, I don't want to mess up my life." If the ego can maintain an awareness of all the emotions that are going on, plus the awareness of not wanting to mess up your life, to wanting to live a meaningful, creative life, then the dreams respond. In the same way with the I Ching. It's like you are consciously trying to create a dream. Now, the teachers who taught this class said to us, I don't always follow this, maybe I should. She said, "You really should only throw the I Ching when you have beg the unconscious for the dream and you don't get any." Mm-hmm. Take your pick. I wait until I feel it is something. Like, I'm not going to ask it, shall I go to Florida or shall I go to Texas for a vacation? But shall I pursue this relationship? Shall I end this relationship? Shall I work on this book? Shall I not work on this book? Shall I accept this invitation? then I'll ask it. If I have a feeling of doubt. In that case, my unconscious is activated, which means there is an archetype that is also activated within me. And that somehow creates the field in which the I Ching works. This is how it was explained to me, anyway.
Can I say something? My experience, when I ask a question that was, you know, not the question that needed to be asked, I got the answer I needed.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, okay, Demi, you didn't ask the right question. Here is the answer. It's really quite an amazing thing.
That's also true, yes. That's very important. But, right?
Yeah.
Do you use it in the sense of what they say about changing lines?
Yeah. I just try to make it simple for Ted.
Yeah. I just figured that was. And my understanding is that is the first hexagram you get is the answer, and the second one is that if you follow the first one, this will be the outcome.
Absolutely, yeah. Don't worry, Ted, you don't follow this. I just want to give you the basic.
Right.
For those who know it, let me just say, actually, there are four possibilities for each line, not two. And you get either a broken line or a straight line, and that line can be static or dynamic, static or moving. And so that you, when you throw it, you might get a moving line here, moving line here. You get one. Sometimes you get one or two. Sometimes you get none. And then you redraw the hexagram with this line changing into its opposite in the second hexagram. You literally look up in the back of the book, there's a chart with each hexagram listed. Then you go to the page in the book that describes it. That's why it's called the Book of Changes. Because the initial situation is often an unstable one, which, and it's like to say, apropos our time discussion, at this moment of time, have a certain quality to it which is unstable and has within it the tendency to transform into this situation. So you may have a very positive response here and a very negative response here, which would mean like the short-term effects are going to be good, but the long-term effects are going to be disastrous. So you really need to see how there is a transition, which would correspond to a dream, to the way a dream begins and the way a dream ends. Same thing, I think. And then, for those of you who know it, really, the most specific advice comes from the advice on these moving lines. If you often get contradictory advice between the general commentary on the hexagram and the specific commentary on the lines, you always give precedence to the commentary on the lines.
On the changing lines.
On the changing lines, yeah.
Who was it you said? Which book do you like
the
best?
Well, I just know Wilhelm.
Wilhelm.
Translated by Carrie Baines.
Baines?
Yeah, everyone's got their favorite, but I just happen to like Wilhelm. There's another good one, which is, how shall I say it, more of a pop version, called The I Ching Workbook by Wing.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm stumped, I'll consult. But what Wing did was simplified a bit, which is nice if you're really confused. But he does lose, I think, some of the subtlety. Is the translation accurate? That's been discussed forever and ever and ever. The professor told me that she thought it was pretty accurate, but she said you could detect the Christian bias.
Where did this
Wing?
Wilhelm.
Where did this come from in terms of Asian?
China.
I mean, where? I mean, does it come out of the monastery or some kind of a contemplative kind of thing? Or?
It's so old, one doesn't know. It was first an oral tradition. I think, you know, it's probably at least 5,000 years old.
Yeah, the King Wen sequence was scraped on bone shards.
And how old was he, do you know?
That's about 5,000.
5,000. And then subsequent generations have added, like the, sort of like the...
It's the world's oldest book is what it's considered.
Is it? Sort of like the Talmud, you know, each generation added another layer to it. So the book we have now is a compilation of that King Wen layer, as Tom called it, with other subsequent sages having interpreted what that said. I didn't realize it was the world's oldest book, but... Okay. Well, I hope that was a useful detour.
That was very interesting.
What I hope to leave you with, for those of you who know the I Ching, is what the creative power of the universe is. That I would be desperate. The I Ching would say, wait, and then one in a million chance was fulfilled. Through intervention by the outside world.
It's interesting that you say that. I have a similar friend, but I won't go into it. Very similar to yours.
In school or something.
Yeah, yep. In school. Me and money.
Yeah.
And it happens.
Yeah. That's the creative power of the universe. That's what hexagon number one is. Your own personal creativity and the good graces of the universe. It's the only way now I know how to put it.
Do you know anyone that teaches a class on Wilhelm's I Ching?
No, but I tell you, in preparing this, I was going to read you part of this. It's the Wilhelm's commentary on the I Ching today. I'm thinking maybe doing a talk on this sometime. Okay. It's so wonderful. He was just... I'll read you some stuff about him soon. He just must have been an amazing human being. I don't know, did you see... No, I guess it wouldn't apply. No, I was thinking of that movie. What's the movie that I mentioned to you? It was set in... China. But that's a different area. Sorry, I forget. But he was a Chinese missionary. That's how it... he was a Protestant minister, and it was a missionary. As you may have heard me say, he bragged that he never baptized a single Chinese.
What's his name?
Wilhelm.
Oh.
Richard.
Oh, okay.
Richard. We'll talk about him in a minute.
Yeah, what were his birth?
He died in 28, I think.
28.
He died very young. He didn't make 50, I don't think. Mm-hmm. Or just... I was preparing this earlier, and I see his wife as a biography, which I'm going to try to find. Undoubtedly, it's in German. I'm going to try to find it. If you want just a quick story, he was a sinologist. He loved China and went there as a missionary, but did not proselytize. Went there to study Chinese culture. And he's the guy then who sent the Secret of the Golden Flower to Jung, which gave Jung the courage to feel he had discovered something. So both Pauli and Wilhelm were enormously important in Jung's creative development. Probably more importantly, as I'm going to read you, he says... I can't read without getting choked up. I feel myself so very much enriched by him that it seems to me as if I had received more from him than from any other man. He really loved Wilhelm, I think. But Wilhelm, you know, being the good Christian he was, came back and tried to forget China. Tried to adapt to the West. And died. Mm-hmm. Jung, I guess he fell into some sort of... Maybe he got dysentery or something, I don't know. He had a fever, and Jung went to see him, and he told Jung some of his dreams or visions, you know, in the fever, and they were all being back in China. And Jung said, dear man, you cannot just adapt to the West. You've got to honor your love of the East. And they refused to accept that and died. We'll talk a little bit more about him. Because I'm going to read you... He makes some comments on what he thinks the meaning of some hexagrams are in a couple of dreams, and I'm going to read you what Wilhelm says. I think he says it a little better. Okay, you still with me? So that was hexagram number one. We'll come back to Wilhelm. I am really fascinated by the man. He was an enormously creative individual, I think. One of these quiet creators, you know, he just wrote fantastic stuff.
See, where did I stop? Oh, Jesus. Never you get through the dream. That's bad. He reflects for a moment and then appears to understand something and extends his hand up over the river. Immediately, a man comes out of the river. He has black hair, but a face bathed in light, with characteristics of the Persian, the blonde, and the shadow. At that, the man with the striped nose says to the other, "Do you know that you have lived before?" One who came out of the river says, "No." The first says, "Everyone was shocked when you went into the river. But I noticed your post-mortal effects. For example, these three pieces of wood here." Synchronicity. And the Lord Trinity. This gave me the certainty that you only appear to be dead. The man answered, "Now I am beginning to remember something from before." The man with the striped nose disappeared as well as the three pieces of wood. The man with the dark hair and illuminated face who had come out of the river alone remained. He seemed to be very happy to be back on land again. So, it's kind of long. The main idea, a man goes into the river, comes out of the river transformed. That's the main idea. A blonde man, we've talked about the blonde, remember the archetypal dimension of science in a mental sense, gets a striped nose and eventually disappears from the scene. In the meantime, he sees this image of the lower Trinity, the triangle on the ground.
You mean the wood?
The wood, yeah. I'm anticipating a bit, but yeah, he sees the wood on the ground. Three pieces of wood. We'll be talking about those as the lower Trinity. I'll explain all that. Okay? Pali felt, it obviously has to do with a transformation of the archetype of the self as a result of the intervention of consciousness. See, more uncommitted archetype thinking. So what? The new form of the archetype corresponds to Mercurius in alchemy. So what? Here he is, the man who comes out of the river. That says nothing. It doesn't tell you what attitude in him he needs to transform. What is it in me? What does that look like in my behavior, in my feelings, in my thoughts? What outer situations am I going to have to deal with to effect that? None of that is addressed. Just kind of thinking, labeling of a process, and then he lets it go. That's the uncommitted archetypal thinking that we'll be seeing again and again.
Does he not do any associations with these dreams?
I bet he would say that is an association. With some people, they're so rigid you can't even get them to associate. They just give you an interpretation. I mean, he does better than that in some cases. But this sort of almost what sounds like a commentary on the dream, but if you really think about it, you see it's an attempt to control the dream. To control what the meaning of the dream is.
It seems so separate from himself.
Exactly. Uncommitted.
It's just a generalization in a way.
Right. And pompous. And learned sounding. The author, I think, says picks up a good point. That you don't see Pali's consciousness intervening at all. There's no intervention of consciousness. Then the author goes on.
That meaning that he has a new understanding of
Nature. Well, he's saying that because I have understood something, there has been a change in the unconscious. But if he had understood something, he would have been in the dream. See, he's not in the dream. They're all players, which means they're all pieces of the unconscious, and we don't see anything about him. Normally, you have a dream, I'm walking down the street, and I see a dog, and, then the ego, consciousness, is involved. You can know you're working with that dream, but if the dream is a drama where there's no presence of the dreamer, then you know that the ego is not attached to that process, and that's what we're dealing with here. It's not. I mean, that it is not to criticize the dream on that account, because that's very often the way these dreams occur. They occur as portraits of what's going on in the unconscious. And you're not involved, and that's not unusual, but you have to know you're not involved. You have to know, oh, I'm being shown something for which I have to begin an inquiry. But he doesn't say he's beginning an inquiry. He says he already knows what it's about. And if you talk to somebody like that afterward, let me tell you, you start getting a little nuts, because they know everything. You're just silenced as a therapist.
Does he continue doing this?
It varies. There are all times where you will feel he's getting to get it, and there will be times when you feel this again. And I think it's just important to know, if you're talking to somebody about their unconscious material, where they are. You certainly can't force them.
But he intellectualizes all this.
Right. Again, often, but I wouldn't say always, because we're going to see he does make progress, but he's also pretty pretty aloof from the emotional impact of the process. And, you know, you, those of you who've done this sort of work know, if you're aloof from your unconscious, you'll be aloof to other people. So you can see the beginning of his problems with women. This is what they feel. You know, don't just give me a formula in our conversation. I want an emotion. I heard one of the nicest things I heard this week. A woman had her anniversary. She said, my husband gave me the most beautiful present for our anniversary. What do you think it was?
He cried.
No? But in that direction.
Kind.
He talked to her.
He listened.
Isn't
that nice? That came out of a lot of hard work. Again, the author goes on. He doesn't engage the self. He's watching. Now, what could it mean? He goes on the second paragraph, around 44. Well, Pauli had sort of a little schema for himself, that the north represented intuition and the south represented sensation, which kind of fits a little bit. You know, the southern Italians are much more sensate. And the Germans and the Scandinavians do have this kind of mystical side. Don't know how to put it otherwise. You think they're very rational, but they're, get them drunk, and you'll see, enormously irrational and mystical side. And I think that's why he made that distinction. So that I think is valid. So the river is going from south to north, so it's talking about intuition. Now we saw that issue before. What's that trying to tell him? What to what time frame does intuition belong? Future, yeah. So it's trying to show him how his future development should unfold, both his personal development and I think that he's working on something really for the future of us. It's the big future. It's not just his personal future. It's our future. Now, the dark man goes into the river and comes out. Pauli uses the word light-dark. What's going on? So this is the figure we originally saw as the blonde and the Persian. And he is going through a transformation where those two sides are now going to be expressed in one person. That's a good thing, but what's involved?
It's showing the unconscious.
Yeah, it's showing that there is the unconscious is showing the direction of his development is to unite his mental grasp and his emotional grasp of life. And that can happen.
that this this archetypal way of understanding that he's trying to develop in science, when we talked about the archetypal background of an idea, and this idea that time is inadequately conceived in science because it only recognizes one dimension, when in fact there are two dimensions. That's the blonde. But that is also true for his personal life, and that's the Persian. And these two are coming together. Now, it doesn't mean that has happened. It means that there's a gradient in the unconscious for that to happen. That is thinking and is living on the understanding of what is creating life from the archetypal base of life and how that works through these synchronistic events. That's becoming clear to him. Practically speaking, that the woman he needs will appear. So this is all being foreshadowed, I think. That's why I said you can see in the dreams that down the road something's going to happen. That something will be the bringing together of these two sides. Maybe so we have a stretch and then we'll go on.